This is Rebecca Chamberlain, Lessons from Mother Earth, January 20th, 1986.
A lot of work in the last few years putting together the language of the Skagit people and also collecting their stories and tales. And Rebecca was privileged and had the skills and talents to be able to work directly with Vi. For, I don't know, how many years?
6 years.
6 years. And she has become an extremely skilled storyteller and has a great deal of not only knowledge of the stories, but of the Salish culture. And so I would like to present Rebecca.
Thank you. I want, first of all, to say that Vi would have liked to have been here this evening. She's not feeling well, but she sends her hutch or her spirit here to be with us tonight. And before we begin, I would like to call on one of Vi's other special students, a young man from Puyallup, who's grown up there, who started working on the Salish language, and from a very early age, of about 8 and 9, he started working with the elders and has in his mind that he wants to help continue the language of this place. And because he's so gifted in the way he uses the language in a creative, I asked one of my close friends and one of Vi's best students, Zeke, to open this meeting tonight in the Lushootse language that is the language of the Puget Sound region and has been for ages. So, Zeke.
To all my friends here, I say hello. It's good to see each and every one of you that are here. We have gathered here in this home, this place here, so that we can share these stories of the Indian people with you. These stories are sacred. They come from our ancestors. They're very old. And at the same time, they have humor. They teach us many things. Teach us how to live our lives. And because of that, the stories are very important. And I am thankful tonight to each and every one of you for taking the time from your busy schedule in today's world to come here and spend this short amount of time with us so that we can share these stories that are on the film, and the stories that Rebecca will tell you tonight. From my heart, I thank each and every one of you tonight. Dahadut.
Thank you, sir. I'm going to share stories for about 45 minutes here to an hour, and then we're going to take a short break and come back for a very special presentation on the videotape that was collected last spring, a gathering of elders. So we'll have two different ways of looking at the stories tonight. One is the kind of gatherings that we have now in places like this, where stories are coming out in a public way and being shared between people who may be familiar and those who may not be familiar with the culture at all. And then we'll take that break so that we can adjust our thinking a little bit, so that we can look at those elders who have shared those stories from the time that they were little children, who have jokes about the stories, who have heard the stories over and over, so that they build a context and understanding about the stories that has enriched as they have in their lives. And as they've aged, that wisdom comes back and is reflected through the story. So I feel that we're going to have two very different kinds of things going on tonight. And these two streams of the elders and their wisdom, the kind of teachings that they can bring us, very concise and humorous form, along with what people are doing now to try to maintain the importance of the oral tradition. And I think it really is important, especially here in Puget Sound, where we're so connected still to the mountains, the forests, and the salt waters of this place. We all have those experiences with nature, with ourselves, of learning from the world around us, perhaps how to be a better person, to relate to other peoples, or just how to protect the world as it is now, to preserve it for the coming generations. And we're all gathering that perspective. We're doing that, many of us, in the best ways that we can. But these stories are the most ancient teachings on this. They've evolved for years, maybe using some Jungian terms. The collective unconscious, as it's interacted with the environment in this place, has created these important teachings that teach people how to live wisely with the earth and with each other. And so on this winter evening, I'd like to bring to you a story about wind and water. How many of you went to work this morning and found yourselves flooded out, or had your homes flooded over the weekend? We're still very much in touch with the raw elements of the natural world. And there are stories of storm wind and north wind, and a number of epic stories about the seasons and the cycles of nature, especially the winter seasons, which are some of the most powerful in our response to the natural world. But I'm going to tell a very short story that happened a long time ago up at Lummi. The rain was coming down so hard that it was flooding all the lowlands. And the wind was blowing so hard that when people went out of their house to go down to the beach to gather food, the waves would come right up and wash them out into the ocean. If they tried to get into a canoe to travel anywhere, the waves would just come up and swallow them down. And so the people had to stay inside the house, their big longhouse, And they were closed inside the walls, and they were gathered together around a small fire, and they were eating the last of their food. And they were really unhappy staying there, knowing that they didn't have any food left and they didn't have many days left because the storm was so strong, the south wind. And they were waiting and just hoping that something was going to change. And one night, an old woman, Flute Slade, came walking in the door. And she circled around the house, and she came in and she sat down. And they welcomed her. "Grandmother, come in. You can share the last of our food with us, but this is all we have." And she said, "I know." And then she smiled at everybody. And she led the old woman over into the corner. And all night, the old woman sat twisting on cedar bark and making long ropes. They started weaving these ropes together. And they were making a large net. And they were laughing. And they were saying, "Oh, wait till the south wind finds about this. The south wind is really going to hear about this." And they worked all night. And the next morning, everybody had laughter. And they all went to the house, and they started working with the old women, and they worked all that day and through the next night and into the next day. And this Tsladai, this old woman, took them out, and she got into a canoe, and the waves just parted in front of her, and she took that canoe right out to the water. And the wind was still blowing, but they could see this trail or this path that she made right out to the waves. And she yelled back, "When you catch us, the wind will stop." So the people, they were pulling on their side of the net, and she pulled the net way out, and they were thinking, "What are we supposed to catch?" They kept pulling on the net. She kept going further out. They could hardly see her. And then when the net was firm and pulled as tight as it could be, it wove all the waves together. And when the waves stopped, the wind stopped. And when the wind stopped, the sun just came out, and it was so bright and beautiful. The people went down to the beach, and they dug some clams, and they got some crab and some salmon and halibut and all their favorite foods. They gathered right up on the beach, and they built a big fire, and they were roasting things there. They were so hungry. This was the first fresh food they'd had in a long time. And they wanted to thank this old woman, this grandmother, who had come to help them. And they looked all over for her. She just disappeared. She was gone. They didn't know where she came from. They did remember what she said. "If you catch us, the wind will stop." And they thought about that. And to this day, people know that if you have the power to catch the waves in the net, you can always stop any storm or any wind from blowing. So that is the story. This happened right up at Lummi Island, right off of Lummi Island. All these stories have a place where they happen. Many of these sacred places are still there, are still valued, and seen as powerful places. And it's nice as you go through these stories to start getting acquainted with the places that they have been told in and from. I'm going to tell a story now that I've never told in public before. It may be the last time. This story is one of my teacher, Vi Hilbert's, favorite stories, and it came out of her recent publication of Habu. This is being published at the University of Washington Press, and tomorrow evening I think she'll be signing some autographs down at Elliott Bay Books if you want to go down and see this book. My assignment is to be able to tell all the stories in this book, plus many others. And this is one of the stories that tonight with the unions, I felt I could dare bring out in public for the first time. And it's one of those stories that's a challenge myth and a trickster myth and all of those wonderful things, and an epic story woven in. And I think it's very interesting in terms of human character and the psychology of people interacting. This story teaches us a lot about power and challenges. And the honorable people of this earth who can sort of transcend that, all those power issues around them. This is the story of Coyote, Spiao. Now, he lived in a beautiful valley, and he had a beautiful daughter. And a family from another village got stuck on his daughter. They really liked her. They thought she was beautiful. And she was so capable. Everything she did was just right. She knew exactly how to gather food and prepare it. And they decided that their son should marry Coyote's daughter. So they brought over a whole bunch of dabiks, a bunch of gifts. And they left them at Coyote's house. And he was taking this really well. This attention to his daughter and all these gifts made him feel so important. And he liked it. So he invited everybody over. But there was a condition to their marrying his daughter. He said, if you think you're going to marry my daughter, well, that's one thing. But you're going to have to win her. You're going to have to earn her. It's more than just these dabiks, these gifts. You're going to have to challenge my daughter to a race. And if you can beat her, then you can have her for a wife. And then Coyote told his daughter, you're going to have to beat this man because I want you to marry somebody from a better family. So there she was, but she was getting instruction. She was training every day, getting up at sunrise, doing all the things that she needed to do to beat this man. They brought over all kinds of food. And the day of the race, the valley was just full of people and animals and birds. And even the fish came up to see this race. It was a big, big event. And the family who brought all the food became very important because they were feeding all of these people who were gathered. And Coyote was happy because this was making his family so important. And the day of the race came, his daughter was instructed, and she took off and she beat that man. It wasn't even a race. And Coyote said, well, I hope there's no hard feelings here. She did it honestly. She beat him. And I guess the races are just going to have to continue until somebody beats her. And the Coyote family was getting lots of attention now. And Coyote was thinking, you know, there's a lot of powerful people here, and they're using Siyad, the most powerful language, to name things. So I'm going to start placing judges all around the tracks, the most powerful spiritual people who know the language, the inner language, the spiritual language of everything. So none of these races are going to be crooked. Everything's going to be just right. Everybody's going to win on their own strength. So he placed these people around the tracks. And then Raven decided he was going to go next. And he had an advantage because he could just fly and she had to run. So they had an argument. This was going to be a foot race. And Raven, if he was going to fly, still had to keep his feet on the ground. Now, Raven just didn't like that. And he was going to cheat, you know, fly and then hop and fly and hop. And he was going to beat that girl. He wasn't going to let a girl beat him. So he got out there and he kept up for a ways, but he started getting tired. His legs just couldn't keep going. So he lost the race. But he said, Coyote, it might have been a disadvantage to me. I should have had two chances. I should have two chances to beat her. And he called all of his cousins, all the birds came, and he said, we're going to host a big party, and because we're going to feed everybody here, I should get a second chance. And he was real tricky, Raven. You know that. But Coyote was also real tricky. He said, okay, Raven, you can have a second chance at beating my daughter, but this time you can't even use your wings. But Raven was stuck now. He had to feed all the people. And his cousins had been there listening, and there was nothing they could say about it, and they had to feed all the people. So everybody was there eating the food that the birds brought into this race, and Raven just wilted. He couldn't run against that girl at all. It wasn't a race at all. And then Mink's turn, Buschub. It was his turn, time, and he was going to go out, and he was going to beat her. And Mink was very passionate. He had to have a woman, had to have this woman. No other man could have her. And he was always showing off those parts of himself that made sure that people recognized what a man he was. And it was quite dramatic because his legs were so short. So Mink went around and marched around and showed off. And all the time he was thinking how he was going to beat this girl. He was going to use that language, that power language. He was going to slow her down, ask for another race, slow her down some more, ask for another race, slow her down. Try to get his legs to grow longer and using this special language that he had the power to. And then he was the fourth race. He was going to beat her. So the first race started and he slowed her down some. But he sped himself up too. But the judges, they all caught on. They were all more powerful in the language of Siyad than Mink was. And so they kept the race even and she beat Mink real easily. And he was such a runt anyway. So he asked Coyote for a second chance. And Coyote said, well, you saw what happened to Raven. The second chance, he didn't do any better than the first time. I don't think that you should have a second chance. You can have it, but you only get two chances. And Mink just wilted. He knew that he couldn't beat that girl. Not in two times. So the races went on, and Coyote's daughter was getting more and more confident. She saw how her training was paying off. She saw how she could beat anybody there, and there wasn't anybody there that she wanted to marry. So that made it really easy for her. So she just challenged everybody, and she was walking around very free. Like, and she was proud. There might not be anybody who could ever catch her. She liked that. But up in the mountains lived a family. This was the goat family. They were really Siap, really high class people. They were honorable. They were honest. They did everything in the most traditional and the best ways. They always had a house full of wealth. They always had plenty of food, not only for the winter, but to give away to everybody else. They had all the wealth of the mountains in their home. And this father, this old goat, was so powerful in his language and with his Siyad that he knew just through his dreams what was going on down in the valley. Nobody had to come up and tell him. He was figuring all this out. And he decided, as he was watching Coyote's daughter, that she would be a good wife for his son. And so he told his son, this before the sun came up one morning, they were there talking, and his son was a really good listener. And he told his son, you're gonna go down to the valley. Now, yesterday you were just a boy. Today you're a man. And I want you to go down to the valley and to win Coyote's daughter. I think you're going to bring her back. And the goat boy said, yeah, I'm ready. I'll do it. And the daughter was listening. Their mother had died. And she was listening. And her power was the ability to read people's minds. She could go right into anybody's mind. And just like it was, she was listening to them talk to her. And she wanted to go along too, but her brother didn't want her to because she knew she'd be reading everybody's mind and causing trouble. She said, no, I won't do that. I don't want to cause any problems, but I'll tell you this. If anybody doesn't like you or doesn't like our family, I'll let you know about it, and I'll let them know about it. And if you don't let me go along, I don't think you're going to win this race. And still, the goat boy didn't want his sister to go along, but the father said, no, she's right. She's going to need somebody to travel with this girl when you bring her back home. So why don't you let your sister go along? So the whole goat family got together. The three of them packed all of this wealth from the whole mountain inside a tiny little pack. This pack was so small you could hardly even see it when it got all put together. And the goat boy just put it on his shoulder and they went down in the valley. And they came up to everybody and they said, we're here. We're here to have fun and join these games, and we're just here to play. We don't even care if we bring Coyote's daughter back home with us. We're just here to have a good time and to entertain you folks. Coyote just really wilted when he saw these goats acting like that, just so carefree and confident. And then they opened up this pack of food, and it filled up the whole field. There was enough food there to feed people for months. This was really Siap. This was really a wealthy, high-class, honorable family. And all the judges were won over immediately. They knew that nothing was going to be crooked about this race. So the goat family got together, and the first thing Coyote did is he went over and he looked at that goat boy's legs. And he thought, gee, those legs are pretty skinny. I don't think he can beat my daughter. And he was really smug and happy about that. And the goat girl was listening, and she laughed. Coyote, you think you know everything, don't you? His legs aren't that skinny. And the day of the races came. The goat girl, or the goat family, was up at dawn, and Coyote family was up at dawn. They both knew about proper training. But that goat girl hadn't gone to sleep that night. She'd walked up and down that field, up and down the valley. And everywhere she went, she collected all the negative thoughts that were coming towards her brother. All the negative thoughts that were coming towards her family. She just collected them. She held them inside of her. And the next morning, she just stood at the starting point. She just walked back and forth, not bothering anybody. She didn't have to because all the negative thoughts had already been collected ahead of time. And then the race started and that goat boy just ran right past Coyote's daughter. It wasn't hard for him at all. Just sort of played and ran along. Well, he won. And Coyote said, "Whee!" His power left him. He said, "I have to acknowledge the fact that your son beat my daughter and that you're now going to be my family and that I will let you marry her. It was done fair, and I know this, and so now you're my family." But he was still having a hard time realizing that the goat family was powerful. They didn't look powerful. There was nothing extraordinary about them except that they could bring all this food down and that the boy just beat his daughter. So they entertained everybody, and people stayed for months just enjoying the food and the games and the fun that the goat family provided for them. But finally, it was time to go back up into the mountains. So the goats got all their belongings together, and they fixed Coyote's daughter in the language of Siwa, named all of the parts of her body so that she could now climb the mountains just like the goat family could. But they didn't do anything to Coyote. And the morning that they were ready to go, he said, "I have to go. I have to be with my daughter. I need to make sure that she's going to be in a good home." But he was full of mischief. It was not fair. He wanted to be in their home for what it would benefit him. So he went along, and when he got to the steep parts of the mountain, he was thinking, "How am I going to climb this big mountain here?" And the goat girl read his thoughts and she laughed and she said, "How am I going to climb this big mountain here?" And the goat boy said, "Oh, Coyote, don't you know how to do this? Oh, we thought you knew how to do everything. You're so siyap, you're so high class, you're so powerful. We thought you knew how to go everywhere, do everything. We thought you could just fix yourself up." Yeah, I can. So the goat boy decided to help his father-in-law, and he named all the parts in his father-in-law's body. But Coyote doubted it. He figured it was probably really him that did it, and the goat boy was just pretending to name the parts of his body. But Coyote, from that moment on, was just really strong, and to prove how superior he was to this whole goat family, he just kept right ahead of them all the way. And it was easy for him. He really doubted that they had anything to do with it at all. But he kept ahead of them. And since he was going so far ahead, they yelled ahead, "Better watch out for our dog. Don't be afraid when the mountain shakes. It's just our dog. He does this when strangers come." So Coyote went on ahead, but he completely forgot about it, and the mountain just shook. Boy, it really shook all over. Coyote hung on. He said, "Oh, help me. There's this terrible beast who's in control of this mountain." And they said, "Oh, Coyote, that was just our dog." But he's starting to think that this family might be pretty powerful by this point. And when they finally got into the cave, which is in the center of the mountain, when they walked in, it's a small little opening, but when they got inside, it was so big. There was everything in this cave, everything that you needed to survive. All kinds of food. And he was really happy. Coyote was happy. He was going to have a good time here. And he started eating lots at every meal. And before long, there was a baby born to his daughter, the coyote girl, and his son-in-law, the goat boy. He loved that grandson. He always wanted to be changing that baby's diapers. Now, these diapers were made out of tallow. Now, up in the mountains, it's a soft little blanket, this fat, this tallow, it's very thin. And Coyote would tear chunks out of the diaper and eat it. He really liked that. And the goat family was really wondering about this. And his daughter, his own daughter, accused him of eating the diaper tallow. Him, Coyote. He He was furious it was all a lie. But they would still catch him sneaking pieces of that tallow. But she couldn't stand that idea. Pretty soon, Coyote was so mad at his daughter that he didn't want to stay up there. He didn't care how much food they had. And so he decided that he was going to go back down home. But before he did, he was going to show them. He saw a tool that he really liked. It was a sharp awl, very sharp and pointed. It wasn't like anything he'd seen before. So he decided he was going to steal that. And all night, he went running down that mountain as hard as he could. He got about halfway down. He was tired and out of breath, so he laid down and went to sleep. Now, he forgot that he was in the house of Siap, honest people, honorable people, and that you just don't steal things from those kinds of people and get away with it. And when he woke up the next morning, he hadn't gone anywhere. He was laying there in the house with sweat all over him, with this awl in his hand. And his daughter looked over and she said, "Coyote, what are you doing? Are you trying to steal the tools of my father, of your new father-in-law, my father-in-law?" Coyote said, "No. No, of course not. It's a lie. Don't listen to her." And the goat family said, "Just don't say anything to your father. Just let him stay here." They took the awl back, and everything was like it was. But a few days went by, and Coyote was looking around. "You know, it's not fair that this goat family has all this food up here, and when I'm down in the valley, people don't think I'm that important, as I can't provide them with the kind of food that my in-laws can. You know what would be really great? If I could take all this food back down in the valley, feed everybody, I would be so important. I would show them. I would show them that I now have a grandson from high-class people. And this goat family's really high-class. I admit that now. They really are. I'm really glad my daughter married him. But I should benefit from this." So Coyote, that night when everybody was asleep, took the power that they'd given him. He took a bunch of that food. Now, he didn't take all of it, but he took most of it. And he took it, and he made it into a small little pack, and he put it on his shoulder. And this time he was really going to go. He made sure he got out of the door of the house. It wasn't just pretending and walking in circles. And he walked down that mountain as fast as he could. He had to get back. He had to get to the bottom of the mountain by daylight. He walked all night long. And in the morning he looked over, and there was his son-in-law and his daughter watching him. Coyote had just walked in circles all night long. Well, that was the turning point. Coyote's daughter didn't want to have anything to do with him. She said, "He's not going to change. He's just like he was when he was down in the valley. He's not going to change being up here with you folks. We need to let him go. He's going to be a bad example on this child that we're trying to raise. You need to punish him." So her goat husband thought about it. He said, "I don't like to punish anybody. And yes, we've given Coyote a lot of special power up here. And you're right, he could hurt us with it. But more importantly, he could hurt that child. We need to make sure that child grows up to be Siap. So we'll leave him here. We'll teach him a lesson. But we won't punish him. We'll just lock him in here so that Ha-Ha, the supernatural one, the changer, can come by and teach Coyote. Ha-Ha will give him a gift that will help him get out. We won't just leave him here." So the goat family packed everything that was in that cave, and they left. And they named the language of freezing things from inside out. And they froze the whole mountain from the inside out. And it turned into a frozen dome, a circular, round object. And it would snow, and then it would melt and turn to ice, and snow and melt and turn to ice. And Coyote just watched it. And he could look up through this ice, and he could see the sky overhead, and he could see the stars at night, and he could see the sun. And he could lick the ice and get water, and he's really hungry. And as he was fasting, he had to fast. There wasn't any food. As he was fasting inside this mountain, he started to really feel bad about all the things. He was pretty tricky, it was true. And he started feeling bad about all the things that he'd done and really feeling sorry. And so all the impurities, adz-ladz, washing out of his body. And he was getting stronger and feeling better about himself. And he really wanted to do better. He really was going to try now. And so Haha came to him in a dream and told him that he would help him. What you do, Coyote, is you start digging a hole through this ice. Use your feet, and then you'll use other parts of your body. So Coyote first started with his feet, and when they wore out, he used his elbows. And he was rubbing a hole in the ice, and then when he wore out his elbows, he started licking it with his tongue. And he couldn't sleep. He had to keep awake, because if he stopped licking, the ice would just breeze right back over the opening. And pretty soon, he had a small little hole. And he just fell asleep for a minute. And Haha came to him again in a dream. And he said, Coyote, what you do now is you take your body apart. I'm really going to help you, Coyote. I'm going to help you get out of here. But it's on the condition that when you get out, you change. You have to change when you leave this place. You can't go back to your old ways. So Coyote said that he would. He had really changed. He really had. So he did what Haha told him. He started naming in the language of Syriac the parts of his bodies. And first of all, he took out his eyes. He wondered why Haha told him to take out his eyes. But first of all, he took out his eyes and he stuck them to the hole. And that made him nervous. And this made his job harder. Because now he had to take off his feet. So he took off his feet and they stuck them to the hole. And then up to his knees and then up to his thighs. And then it was just his rear. He had to take off, and oh, he hated that. Oh, it was awful. He had to pass it in front of his nose. Oh, it smelled bad. Oh, he stuck that through, dropped out on the other side. Then it was really hard because he had to take his stomach out, and it was still kind of, you know how he gorged himself all the time, and so it was kind of hard to put his stomach through that hole, but he got that out, and then it was his heart. Oh, his heart, that was going to hurt. He was really concerned that would we be taken care of when it went to that hole and dropped that out. And then his ribs went out, and then his throat. He had to get his throat through. And he was really worried, how am I going to name my throat and push it through the hole at the same time? Now, Haha said, this is a lesson for you, Coyote. You know, your whole life you were lying to people. You were saying things with your throat so you could feed that same throat and just build up all kinds of food in your whole body. And so that's a lesson for you, Coyote. Think about this next time you think your throat is a problem to pass through that hole. So Coyote got his throat through and he named it okay. And he took his arms and his fingers and put them through and then his jaw and then his head and his brains. They all went through. And then he was on the outside, and he was laying all over the place. And he thought, aha, now I'm going to get even with that goat family for leaving me. It was a crooked thought, and he really meant it. So Haha said, okay, your punishment comes now. Because of that crooked thought, you're going to think something. It's going to start you putting your body together wrong. And I'm leaving you now. So there was Coyote laying all over the place on the outside of this mountain. And he remembered, thank goodness, the name for his feet, and then his knees, and then his legs, and then his... Everything started going back together, except for one thing he forgot to start with his eyes. And that was where the punishment came in. And Haha had told Raven. And Raven was having a great time watching Coyote all over in pieces and putting himself together. And he was watching Coyote's eyes, and he thought, I'm going to take those eyes. So while Coyote was putting himself together, he was going faster and faster. He knew the punishment was coming. Didn't know what it was. He knew Raven was going to do it. He knew that. And he was mad. Another crooked thought. Raven came by and he took Coyote's eyes and he said, bye, Coyote. And he flew away with Coyote's eyes. Well, Coyote then heard from Haha. I'm not going to stay here and advise you anymore. But you know that part of yourself that you really dislike? Mm-hmm. Inside there are two little brothers. You're going to call them from this day forward your little brothers. And they're going to advise you. That's where you're going to get all your advice from now on, Coyote. I'm not going to give it to you. So Coyote hated this. Every time he was in trouble, he had to ask his little brothers, come on out, little brothers. And they would say, what do you want, Coyote? And he would say, "What do I do now?" And they would tell him. So the first thing he said, "What do I do now? I don't have any eyes. Raven's taken them." He said, "What you do is you find some leaves and you stick those in there, and as long as they're a little damp, you can see some." So, "Oh, I knew that. Get back in there, little brothers." And Coyote would walk along, and these leaves would be in his eyes. And he's walking along, and he saw some girls picking berries. And he couldn't see very well, so he's picking these berries and pretending he was putting them in a pack on his back. And they said, "What are you doing, Coyote? What are you doing?" "Oh, I'm just picking these beautiful elderberries." And it wasn't even an elderberry bush, and he was throwing them back in his pack. And they said, "Coyote, what's wrong with you?" And they looked closer, and they realized he didn't have any eyes. So the youngest girl said, "Don't you go near him." He said, "No, I want you to come here. I want to show you something. See that really beautiful star way up there?" I said, "No, Coyote, you don't even have any eyes. How can you see a star?" "I can, though." "Well, it's the middle of the day. Don't listen to him." The youngest girl stayed far away, but the oldest daughter sometimes, or the oldest child, gets spoiled. And then they don't listen. They don't learn to pay attention to advice. Well, the oldest girl was really thinking Coyote was funny. So she walked over, and he said, "Here, look right through my hand and lean your head against my arm, and I'll show you. You can see right through my hand that star." When she got over, he dug both of her eyes out and stuck them in his head. And the youngest girl said, "Oh, why didn't you listen to advice? It was just because you didn't listen." And Coyote was gone now. So now that girl had to take the leaves and use them for her eyes. Coyote went on. He walked and he walked and he walked and he walked. For a long time, he was getting tired. He realized he had to ask his little brothers what to do next. So he said, "Come on out, little brothers, tell me what to do." And they came out. He said, "What you do is you just walk along till you find a family who lives along the beach here." So he went, and he found an old woman. Her name was Tukwop. She was sickness. She often comes in the winter. And she was coughing and sneezing and wheezing. And he said, "Now what do I do? Why don't you imitate sickness? Find out all about her." So Coyote watched sickness and talked to her and found out exactly about her family. She had two granddaughters. And they were off at some games. And at these games, people were playing with Coyote's eyes. And he learned all this from this old woman. And learned what she fed the granddaughters. He learned a lot of things about their life there. And then Coyote said, "I'm going to burn you up, sickness. I'm going to take these nettles and rub them all over you and burn you up." And she said, "Oh, please do. That's a favor to me. The medicine from the nettles will help me." So Coyote rubbed her all over. Then he got rid of sickness that way. And that was a favor to her because she was sickness. And he also helped feed her from the roots of the nettles because it had a medicine that could help feed sickness. And that was a favor to her. And so he let her go, and then he dressed up like sickness. And when her two granddaughters came in, it was coughing and wheezing, and then he fell asleep. He was really nervous. He didn't want to pretend that he was sickness. He wanted to watch how the granddaughters were in that house. And after he watched them for a little while, they thought, "This is strange. Grandmother never goes to sleep when we come home." But he was just doing that to watch them. And finally, he pretended that he woke up, and he said, "How were the games today?" "Oh, it was really fun. We liked watching them play with Coyote's eyes." That was fun. And they told about how the two eyes would roll down and one would beat the other and people would bet which eye would win. And Coyote was, he just couldn't stand to hear about this. And he said, "Oh, I'm so sick. You know what poor condition the old woman I am in. I'll tell you what. You take me to those games tomorrow, okay? And it's the last thing I want to do before I die." So they did. The next morning they got their grandmother. And the youngest daughter, again, was very suspicious. Grandmother wasn't acting quite right, so she was watching. And the oldest granddaughter started packing Coyote. And this was too much for Coyote to be packed on the back of this beautiful young woman. He's wiggling all around and pretty soon she sort of dropped him. She said, it's your turn. And the youngest girl picked him up. And he was wiggling all around on her. And she just dropped him really hard. She said, you pack him. Or you pack our grandmother. I'm not going to put up with that. And then they went on. And the oldest girl, pretty soon Coyote was feeling all around this other granddaughter and really having a good time traveling. And she kind of liked it. She was crazy anyway. And she hadn't listened to the advice of her parents. So she let Coyote feel all around, and then she put her down real gently. Time for you to carry grandmother now. And the youngest picked Coyote up, and she's thinking, this isn't grandmother, but I'm not going to say anything. As soon as Coyote started anything, she just dropped her hard. And the oldest girl scolded for dropping grandmother so hard. So she picked her up, and the oldest girl carried Coyote all the rest of the way. And then Coyote said, could you please put me down right at the finish line where the Coyote's eyes go? I'd like to see the races from there. So the people put this old woman right at the finish line, and they watched, and Coyote whispered as the eyes came down, come here. And the eyes sort of shifted towards the old woman, and everybody thought that was amazing, how these eyes just had this shift. And then the next time they rolled down, they jumped towards the old woman. That was even more fun. The next time, they practically flew into her face. And the fourth time, Coyote said, get into my head where you belong, eyes! And they snapped right into his head. And then he threw off the clothes of sickness, and he said, you people, you controlled my eyes. Ha, I bet you thought my race up in the mountains was funny, didn't you, when I had my daughter race, and now you're teasing me and racing my eyes. Well, no more. They're back in my head. I'm back to normal. Everybody said, oh, no. We better chase Coyote and stop him from doing any more mischief. So they were chasing Coyote, and he was running along, and he said, oh, little brothers are going to catch me. What do I do? The first one said, throw me behind you, and I'll turn into a river. So Coyote turned his little brother into a river. He kept running, but the people got across. The second little brother said, throw me down, I'll change into fog. So he threw that little brother down, and he changed into fog. And then they whispered into Coyote's ears, Coyote, you have to swim all the way out to that island. And there, Coyote, you can live all by yourself, so nobody can cause you any problems. And so you can't cause anybody else any problems either. And that's where you have to live, Coyote, the rest of your life, at least this life. And that's the end of Coyote's Eyes. Read the story. There's even some parts that I left out. You have to buy Habu now. There were so many stories that I wanted to tell her because some of these myths, these legends, these sea of hopes, the stories that happened before the change, are so powerful, and I feel like the message that they bring to us can be so educational in our way of relating to the earth today. And what the elders have shared with me and what my teacher has shared with me is that we all share this place now. We all need to take care of it. And I can't imagine a better place to learn than from these legends and stories. They're funny and they're exaggerated and they're extreme, and there's some important lessons that we can get from each one of these tales. People learn better by negative example, as in Coyote's case. And I'm going to tell a story now that comes from a little bit south of this place. Comes from the Kathlamet Chinook people down along the Columbia River to the south. And the reason I'm telling this story because, well, I'll let you see. I think it's an important message for us who live in this time and this age on the earth. It was collected in 1897. So it was in one of the earlier collections by Franz Boas. It's called The Sun's Myth. there was a chief of a village. And his brothers were chiefs of 5 villages. And his village was in the middle. And every day he walked up to the top of a hill before the sun came up, and he waited. He watched for the sun every morning, and he sang and he prayed and he called to the sun. And it helped him. He'd come back down when the sun came up, and he went to work. He did the things he needed to do. He was good for his people. He was good to his people. He helped people make important decisions about their lives. One morning, though, he got up before the sun. When he came back, he asked his wife, "What would you do if I went to see the sun?" She said, "Oh, do you really think the sun is so close you can just go visit?" He said, "Yeah, I'm going to go. I'm going to go see the sun. I want the sun. So make me 10 pairs of leggings and 10 moccasins." And she did. And the next morning, before the sun came up, he started walking. He walked for 1 month, and he wore out 1 pair of moccasins and 1 pair of leggings, and he kept going. For 10 months, he walked and walked, until finally he came to a place where the world shifted. And when he walked through that shift, the trees were bigger than anything he'd seen before. And he came to a house, and inside this house was a young girl, and she was sitting, weaving a basket. And he looked down at her. And then he looked over on the right-hand side of the house, and there were elk skin shields. And there were bows and arrows, and there were wooden armors, and there were clubs, and there were fishing things and canoes. All the way down to the end of the house, he saw all the things that men needed to survive, all the things he'd been busy making when he was on earth. And then he looked over on the other side of the house, and he saw piles of mountain goat wool blankets. And he looked down further, and there were abalone shell necklaces and dentalian shell necklaces. And he looked on down, and there were bowls, wooden bowls, and woven blankets of all kinds. And he looked all down that house, and there was a lot of boxes full of food and wealth and all the things that women gather and make and prepare for the world so people can survive. And then he looked at the girl, and he said, "Who are all these elk skin shields and these bone clubs and these arrows?" She said, "They belong to Kia, my father's mother. And when I become a woman, she's going to give all of this away." And they looked down the house a little bit further, and he asked her about all the other things that were on the men's side of the house. And she always said, "These things belong to Kia, my father's mother, and when I become a woman, she's going to give this away." And they looked down the other side of the house. "Well, whose are these mountain goat wool blankets and these abalone and dentalian shell necklaces and all these woven robes and these tanned hides?" And he named all the things that are down that side of the house, and always she said, "These things belong to Kia, my father's mother. And when I become a woman, my grandmother will give them away." So he liked all these things. He liked it there. And he decided that he was going to take them. So he stayed, and he took those things. And that night, Kia, grandmother, came home. And she brought the best thing of all. She had a robe that shone just like the sun. She folded this robe inside so the light was inside, and she hung it up in the middle of the house, and all night long it twirled around and around, and he watched that light. His eyes stared all night long at Kia's robe. And then he fell asleep. And the next morning, before anybody woke up, Kia was gone. And at night she came home with gifts. And he stayed there, and he liked it. He liked the young girl. He married her, and he liked it there. But then he thought, my people, they must wonder where I am. And now that I'm here with the sun, I want to take them back, the power that I've learned from being here. I can't rest until I've shown them the wealth that the sun's house has, the power that we have when we can come to this place. I have to take it back. So he stayed in bed all that day. And when Kia came home, he turned his face against the wall. He asked her granddaughter, what did you do? Did you scold him? No, grandmother. He just misses his people. Next day, grandmother Kia went out. And all day he said, have her give me her blanket. I want to go home and I want to take her robe with me. I have to have it. And she said, no. Many people have tried to buy this robe from her. She won't sell it. You can't. You can't have it. Don't ask her. So that night, Kia came home. She brought gifts to her grandson and her granddaughter. And she started watching him. She said, oh, grandson, here. Look at all these things I have on this side of the house. Here, I'll help you bring all these things back to your people. She showed him everything, all the wealth on that side of the house. Always he said, no, 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 no. She showed him the blankets and the necklaces and all the wealth on the other side of the house. I want you to take these things back to your people. I want them to be gifts to your people on earth. Please, take these things. He said, no. And he just looked at the robe that was in the middle of the house. That's what he wanted. Grandmother was tired. She turned away. This went on for days, and finally grandmother got very, very tired. She gave him another chance. She walked him through the whole house. All these things are yours, grandson. Please take them. No. She said, okay. Remember, grandson, I tried to love you. I tried to love your people. You go back to your people. And then she put a stone club in his hand and put the robe. She brushed it and he started walking. Glad now. He had the power of the sun. He did. It wasn't very long with this power that he was back at the village of his people. And he saw his first brother's village. And he walked into it, and this stone club started vibrating in his hand, and it said, we will kill your people. We will kill your people. And he lost his mind. He didn't have the strength to watch his mind. And he went to the village and he killed everybody, breaking everything. And when he came to the end of the village, he looked at his hands. And there was a club and it had the blood of all of his brother's people on his hands. And there were just bodies laying everywhere and the houses were broken. He said, oh, I've been so foolish. What I've chosen is so wrong. It's bad. He tried to let go of his club. He couldn't peel it out of his hand. He couldn't loosen his hand. And so he tried breaking it against the earth, and it wouldn't break. He kept going. He couldn't stop. He couldn't hold his feet still, and he kept going. And he saw the village of his second brother, and he tried to watch his hut. He tried, but he lost his mind. And the club started vibrating and said, we will kill your people. We will kill your people. And he went to the village, and he was breaking, hitting everything, destroying everything. And the club just vibrated in his hand, and when he was through with that village, he looked down, and it was quiet again, just blood on his hands, the blood of his people, his brother's people. And he went on. He tried breaking the club off in the fork of a tree. He tried pulling his hand away. He couldn't get it out. He tried breaking it on stone. And he kept going to the village of his third brother. And again, he lost his hutch. This stone hammer kept vibrating in his hand, saying, we will kill your people. We will kill your people. And he went to that village. And again, just the blood and the bodies and everything broken. He tried to purify his body by water. He couldn't break it on earth or stone, so he tried diving into the water. And when he came up, he was at the village of his fourth brother. He destroyed everybody. He destroyed everything. And finally, he was walking towards his own village. He could even recognize his own family, his own parents, his own wife, his own children. And then he lost his hutch. And the axe club vibrated in his hands and it said, "We will kill your people. We will kill your people." And he didn't remember anything else until he came to the end of the village, and just the blood and everything behind him destroyed. And then he cried, "Ka, ka, ka, ka. I give up. I give up. I can't let go. Grandmother. Yeah." And he turned around and there she was. She was behind him all the time, watching. He'd never turned around to see her before. He'd never given up before. Now there was no one left. Kia just took the robe off his shoulder. She said, "Why do you cry now, grandson? I tried to love you. I tried to love your people. Why do you cry now?" She took the axe out of his hand and she went home. He went a short distance and he built himself a house, a very small house. And that's the end of the Sea of Hope. There's a wonderful story that I would like to share with you sometime. It's called Star Child. I think it's one of the most psychologically interesting stories. I spoke with the unions a couple of years ago and told this story, and I don't feel that since we got started late, and we have the video to see still, I don't feel I have time to share it with you. There are many versions of this story. It's the most sacred and special story of the Puget Sound area. It takes between 10 minutes to an hour to tell it properly. Maybe if we have time later on in the evening, if there's question and answers, I can bring part of this story out, because I think it is really one of the most important stories of this area, the Star Child myth. And keep it in mind, even if we don't discuss it tonight. We're going to take a 10-minute break or so, and then come back and watch the elders tell stories. And theirs is a very different tone and a very different context. So, questions or whatever, we can leave it open for that. He has a wonderful reputation as a singer. And he sings all kinds of things. And I think that's a really good question, because when culture is in change or transition, there's a lot of things that you can adapt, and you can change the style of clothes that you wear, you can change the kind of house that you live, you can change the kinds of songs you sing and still be 100% Indian. And I think that that was a really good way to end the videotape, because Indian people now live between worlds. It's something that they have to be share in, and I think it's good that there's that flexibility. It's, I think, hard to be stereotyped as an Indian and have to have braids and beads, and that's wonderful, but I think it's also nice to be able to break out in songs or in other ways to prove a multi-personality in it. I just think it's a real special time and a special hardship as well as a special joy that people can share in when they live between cultures that way. Yeah.
How does the story get started?
How does the story get started?
I mean, looking at something that they notice, like the fish going, or that they could see them out from here, and they at the same time.
I don't know. Unions, what do you think?
That's true.
No one in particular. I mean, it can be anyone in the tribe. It doesn't have to be.
Stories. What I've learned from the elders is that stories can be shared by anybody, and everybody's respected as a storyteller. And traditionally, there were ways that people learned about nature firsthand, went out and learned about nature from the earth. Was, like one of the elders says, the earth is our first teacher. That's where we got the title from the program tonight, was from one of the elders. You leave the lap of your mother and go to your mother, the earth, and learn from her. And I think that, did you hear Gary Hilaire's story about when mountains were people? After that story, Hagen Sam, who finished with that song, or Fillmore James, who finished with the song, said, that is a true story. It's true. That's not just a legend story. That really happened. Yeah. He said it was a child since I've heard that story. And every single one of the stories did have truths and teachings tied into them. And the symbolic and the literal, the earth and the imagination, the daily life and the supernatural are all brought together somehow in stories in a creative way that makes sense as lessons are taught, as teachings are needed to be brought out, as somebody needs to be instructed. I mean, I can imagine why somebody might want to tell the coyote's eyes story. There's a lot of teachings in that story. I don't know. I think the environment evokes stories. I think human interaction evokes stories. I think there's a number of symbolic and literal levels to look at the stories from. And that's the richness of this culture, is all those levels that you can explore it from. It has impacts. You could walk into this room tonight, not know anything about the Northwest, the environment. You could not know anything about traditional culture of this area. And you, coming with all of your associations, could take home a lot from hearing the stories. But enriching the awareness with the environment and with cultural associations, I think, helps add enormous and wonderful dimension. So that by the time you see elders who have lived with these stories for years, you can see how contagious and spontaneous their laughter is. And that comes, and even when the story is told in a nutshell, it's the shortest possible form, those years of growing up together, knowing each other and knowing the story, add all those levels of appreciation to the telling. So you get this incredible laughter that can be shared, I think, sometimes only by people who have lived closely that way with each other's stories and the traditions for a long time. But I don't know. Yeah. There's copies in the first Pabu book that Vi put out, and there's also copies in Suzulo Library of in different collections. Yeah, there's four versions in Habu, and there's many others. It's been collected in collections all up and down Puget Sound. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. This is something I think that's probably fairly sensitive to talk about, but the story really is really a story of power and mentions the Siyed, or the special language of names, that is a language that's, or a way of naming things that's outside of the ordinary way, and it has to do with a supernatural relationship that you have with earth, the earth. So that you know the inside name of things. Zeke, do you want to mention anything about that you'd like to? Yeah.
Even the word name.
Uh-huh.
Relates to the topic you're playing, but in
morning we call the tree, the rest of the life force. The name itself, as soon as you're touching on the name, you're actually connecting to life. When you name somebody, you say your name, you're actually connecting with their life force. So it means that, and when you're in that world, sometimes it's called the life force world, or the Sarah's world, and the word for it. And a person is able to leave the physical and go into the life force world, or the Sarah's world, then they will be in love with the name.
Yeah. Yeah, Martin Sampson, Chief Martin Sampson, has written a book called Indians of Skagit County, and in his book he talks about this and in a little bit more detail, and that I think that would be a good place to go look. Chief Martin Sampson, and he just calls it the mystic words, and I don't know how to describe it. And that's what he names it. He calls it the mystic word.
It isn't even new to us. If you think about it, our Judeo-Christian myth, God creates things by naming them.
And
if you think about, for example, the Joseph story, that when he wrestled with God, then God changed his name. And that he kept, Jacob, right? Then he kept asking, what is your name? And God, or whatever that was, addressing him, would not say, because to name so would have given him
power.
And in traditional Indian culture, as you grow up and as you mature, you take on different identities and different roles and different names throughout your life. You potlatch, or you have a naming ceremony, or there's all these ways that you can honor your ancestors and honor all those people who have carried a name and take on a new name and a new identity and live up to that responsibility that that name entitles you to. And there's a section in a book called Ways of the Lushootse that talks about naming and naming ceremonies and the importance of that too. That was written by Vi Hilbert, and I think you can get it through Daybreak Star Press.
Talk about the high-class people using the word Siab.
Siab is the word for, and it's hard to describe in English. It means high class or noble or honorable. And the only way you can get that name is if you live a clean life, clean outside and inside, clean mind, clean heart, clean body. And it's the kind of thing that you don't call yourself Siab. Like Coyote called himself, it has to be recognized. And it also has to do with, there's a humility that the Siab has that doesn't draw attention to itself. It's recognized by other people as in a special way. And I think it's a wonderful word. Yeah, I think it might fit into that. What do you think, Steve? Is it like honoring somebody with the name prince or princess or noble person? Siab. Sik can certainly be free to help comment on any of this.
Siab is needed in the sense that if someone introduced me to you, instead of saying Mrs. or Ms., you say Siab so-and-so. And it's also used, like she said, when you're meeting a chief or someone like that, is Siab so-and-so.
That's
title,
right.
It's an adjective.
Yeah.
It's a way of being polite. Very formal way. And when you stand up to talk to someone to acknowledge one person, you're going to call them Siab or her Siab, or Siab. So there's a lot of different uses for that, in that it's a formal, and it can be used for a medicine man, for a chief, or someone that you look up to in a formal way.
Yeah.
numbers 10 and 5.
Yeah. In Lushootseed country, you have the number 4. Everything happens 4 times. You go a little bit south, everything happens 5 times. And I think that story is interesting. The 5 tribes, that's the symbolic number of that place. I don't know why. Jung talks about numbers, 4 and 5, a lot, and so we could get into a long discussion about the symbolic dimensions of 4 and 5 found in this area. To me, that the story means the 5 tribes symbolize the whole earth. Because 5 in the Kathlam Chinook country is a number of wholeness or totality. So everything would happen 5 or 10 times. And so that makes the story even more powerful in terms of how my personal relationship to it. It makes it more awe-inspiring. And
they were so connected with astrology too, and the east, the
four directions, six directions, yeah, and this, or six, up and down, plus north, south, east, and west, yeah. Yes, all the tribes that shared in this videotape are Lushootseed speaking tribes, and thank you, Stephen. Except for Lummis, and that's their cousins. They have a cousin language. The Lushootseed language is the language that was spoken from Bellingham south to Olympia, between the Cascade Mountains and Puget Sound, and also over in Suquamish and Tlalit country, over on the Puget, a little bit up in there. Yeah. They would be common to Puget Sound area tribes. And Zeke speaks a dialect of Lushootseed, a southern Lushootseed dialect. He's from Puyallup. He grew up with Puyallup elders. And Vi speaks a dialect of northern Lushootseed along that from the Skagit River. So even within this language group, you have dialects that understand each other but have differences. And so sometimes it's confusing when we talk, because we say things that, or I don't understand southern Lushootseed at all. Fortunately, Zeke has trained himself to know both northern and southern Lushootseed, so he can keep up in most conversations. Achel Gubalachel, Lachel Gubalachel, Lachel Gubalachel, and Dukulachel Gubalachel. Yeah, that was Fillmore James. I keep wanting to, I called him Hagen Sam. Hagen Sam also told that story of Bear and Ant. And that is a chant. That is Ant's power song. Achel Gubalachel. Achel Gubalachel. And then Bear's power. Yeah.
Yeah. Common way of telling stories, or is that something that
I think that's, I don't know. I think it would probably be fairly common in individual. And there's songs, lots of songs in the stories. And people used to compose songs to go with stories. And he had a unique way of singing that song. It was his own special way of singing the song. It was different from Hagen Sam. And he just invested his own spontaneity in the way he composed it and sang it for this event. Blessing. You know, what happens in the story is Aunt is singing for night and day. Night and day. She knows the coming generations need night and day. Bear is singing for a whole year of night, and then one day. A year of night, and then one day. So this is a power of of the whole cosmos. It has really broad implications. And so she wins the contest. She calls for night and day, for balance, for black and white, night and day. And Bear is calling for an unbalanced world, a world where he can give in and sleep. And just come out every so often when he's hungry. So it's a powerful story. And so if it's chanted with that kind of intensity that has cross-cultural and cosmological implications, I'm not surprised. Because we certainly want Aunt to win that contest. She doesn't always win in everybody's life, but yeah. 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 Ah, oh, yeah, the glottals and the clicks in the top of the alveoli, yeah.
I thought that earlier, and I heard a little bit about the African sound, that the people around here, it's more in the throat,
mm-hmm.
and there's a noise, like how you call a horse like that, as if you're blowing out. Now when you the kind of second area, instead of do that, blow it out.
Yeah. Like one of the best.
That's very good. She does that sound a lot, and it's definitely coming from the background, but it's very hollow.
There's a.
Yeah.
There's a little. We have, when we learn the language, we have all these little lessons, and one of them is kutch. And that has that sound. The glottal stop gets impacted somehow with your breath. And the king salmon is in the river. Or Ubutch is king. Scutch is silver, right? Yeah. Ha ha. Uh-huh. Yeah. Ha ha, the creator. Yeah. Well, most of the elders in this, there was one man in his 40s. Well, actually two men in their 40s who participated, but they weren't considered elders even though they told stories. And yet, most of the elders are in their 60s, 70s, 80s. A lot of those elders were in the 80s. One of the things my teacher has told me, though, being an elder does not mean you're old. It just means that you found a way to carry on your cultural traditions in an effective way. So she occasionally will honor a younger person by calling them an elder. And it's always surprising for the elders to realize that they really are the elders. That that's their, you know, they're there. Because they have such a reverence and a respect for that generation that's come before. They always look to that generation, those ones who've trained them. Those are always their elders. They're always referring back to them. So those elders are also thinking of elders who were thinking of elders as they trained the younger people. So there's this beautiful connection to the past. And elders are wonderfully acknowledged always in all aspects of life. So, yeah. My studies have gone. Our northwest coast have gone south as far as the Columbia River and north on up into west coast, Kwakutl or Kwakiutl, Tlingit, Haida. I'm interested in other cultures, but my primary study has been Puget Sound Salish right here. Yeah. Okay.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle. and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.